On this week's 51%, we learn about some of the first American women to ever command military aircraft, not for the US, but for Great Britain during World War II.
Decades before other women had these opportunities, these women seized this opportunity and they excelled at it.
We also speak with former CIA agent Christina Hillsburg about why she feels women make better spies. I'm Jesse King, it's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Leader. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Today we're bringing you a pair of interviews about powerful but little-known women in American history. Did you know, for example, that American women didn't start flying combat missions in the U.S. until the 1990s? Of course, women at that point have been flying for decades, including for the military. But even so, some of the first American women to fly military aircraft at all did so not for the U.S. military, but for Great Britain during World War II. Before the U.S. formally entered that war, Great Britain was desperate for pilots to transport aircraft between military bases. The Air Transport Auxiliary recruited pilots that were otherwise considered unsuitable for the Royal Air Force, including women. Our main guest today is journalist Becky Aikman, who has a new book out sharing the stories of some of those women called Spitfires, the American women who flew in the face of danger during World War II. Pulling from unpublished diaries, old letters, family stories, and in-person interviews, Aikman describes how dangerous this work was and why 25 American women jumped at the opportunity to do it.
These pilots who went, there were 25 of them, and they were all experienced pilots from really different backgrounds who wanted to fly in the war. The United States hadn't yet entered the war, but it had already decided that it would not accept women pilots in the U.S. military. At this point, Great Britain was in desperate straits. The rest of Western Europe had fallen to Germany. Britain was standing alone. It was under constant attack from bombers every night. Many people killed, much destruction. They desperately needed aircraft and they desperately needed pilots. So they decided to start this rather ragtag operation that was called the Air Transport Auxiliary. They were willing to accept people who would not be accepted into the Royal Air Force. This would be people who had injuries, people who were too old to serve otherwise, foreign nationals, and even women. And the women in it were called attagirls. Their job was to transport aircraft from factories where they were churning them out as fast as they could to airfields and bring severely damaged aircraft back from airfields to maintenance units where they could be repaired. This was one of the most dangerous jobs of the war. One in seven of these pilots were killed in crashes. This is because these aircraft that were coming out of the factory so fast it were barely tested, and they often failed in the air, leading to crashes. The aircraft that were coming back from frontline bombing missions were often shot full of holes. They had doors missing. They had parts taped together. Pilots did not know what might go wrong until they were high in the sky. This also led to many crashes. And the other factor that made the job so dangerous was British weather. It was very changeable. They would frequently wind up in zero visibility conditions, and they were not flying using instruments. So many pilots crashed into mountains or church steeples or anything that they might encounter when they weren't able to see. So it was a really tough job and a really dangerous job. It also was an exciting job for these pilots because they were in a position to fly up to 147 different models of aircraft, all of the latest, most advanced fighters, bombers, transport planes, you name it. They were very excited to get this experience in all these aircraft in the hope that someday they could get jobs after the war as pilots.
I'm curious, you know, how did you go about looking these women up and learning about them? Obviously, you know, it was a long time ago now, but are any of them still with us? Did you get to meet them?
It was really hard to track them down because they weren't famous after the war. They actually were rather famous during the war. They were written up a lot and covered a lot because it was considered so exciting and so noble for these women to do this work. But after the war, historians weren't paying attention to them, probably because they were flying in another country. So it was really hard to find information about them at first. A few of them had left diaries and letters to archives, and that was tremendously helpful to me. But most of them, I had to track down the families, and they were so excited to have their mothers and aunts finally being recognized that they went into attics and found a tremendous cache of diaries and letters and other keepsakes from the war that they were delighted to share with me. So I was able to really get inside the heads of these pilots because I had their most personal and emotional reflections on everything that was happening. I was very fortunate that way. By the time I started the book, only one of the pilots was still living, and I have had the privilege of interviewing her. She is now the last surviving transport pilot in the world, at the age of 106, and still has a very sharp memory of the war, which was the highlight of her life, as it was for most of the women. Also, family members shared memories that their mothers and aunts had shared with them about it. So it took a lot of work, but eventually I was able to really tell their story in the most intimate way. I just felt I knew these women as if they were my closest friends by the time I was writing it.
Well, tell me a little bit more about some of the women you feature here and what they did.
One of the things I love the most about this story is that these women came from a complete cross-section of America. Most of the women who flew in Great Britain were from very aristocratic upper-class backgrounds because that's who could afford to learn to fly. The women in my story range all over the place. There was one who was a crop duster, and she earned extra money by performing a mock striptease in air shows, where she would make passes over the airfield and toss items of clothing out of the cockpit. Then she would land fully clothed. There was another who was a debutante from one of the wealthiest families in America, the family of the Western Union fortune. She did not like that future that was before her. She was attracted to women rather than to men. And when she discovered flying, it gave her a great freedom to break away from those family expectations. And during the war, she was able to live as she pleased, far away from home. There was another pilot named Dorothy Fury. She had a very impoverished background in New Orleans. She had only an eighth grade education, but she was well self-educated. She was also very beautiful. And when she went to England, she was able to pass as a sort of American heiress. She brought one red dress that she recycled for every occasion, and she was welcomed into the upper classes in Great Britain and eventually married her way to the top. I'll give you another one. Her name was Anne Wood. She was the president of her college class and was very much like women today. She wanted a serious career in government or diplomacy or something like that. And she took advantage of the fact that the American pilots were welcomed everywhere and were the toast of the town in London. She made contacts with diplomats, journalists, generals, spies, business people, in the hope that this would help her have the connections she needed to have a solid career after the war. So they were all really different people. They had different levels of skill in their flying. So their stories really developed over time during the war. Anne Wood, for example, was a rather timid pilot at the beginning and eventually emerged as someone considered one of the top pilots in the air transport auxiliary. Virginia Farr was also always promoted ahead of the others to the most advanced aircraft, which led to some rivalries and jealousies among the group. Others struggled a bit, but those who made it to the end had absolutely steady nerves because they were constantly in situations of great danger where aircraft would fail, and they had to be very resourceful in how to get themselves out of these messes. One of them, named Hazel Jane Rains, was from Georgia, and she had been a stunt pilot there. And she got into one of the most dire situations. Her engine failed in a Spitfire fighter just as she entered clouds and lost all visibility. Her aircraft went into a deadly spin, but fortunately, she had performed spins in air shows back home where the audience would scream in terror as she aimed toward the ground. So that experience doing that allowed her to save herself, if not the aircraft, which was totally demolished.
Wow. Yeah, it's really good that she had that experience to pull from in that moment. I guess what was the training like for this work? As you said, people were coming in with such a wide range of knowledge about flying.
That was a key component of how slapdash the whole process could be. When they got to Britain, they would be trained in four different classes of aircraft, starting with very simple single engine aircraft that were used for training purposes. They would learn to use one model of aircraft in that category. And at that point, they were cleared to fly anything in that category with no other training. They carried something called the pilot's ferry notes, and it had one page on each aircraft that basically said, here's how you make it go, here's how you make it stop, good luck. The next category was the fighters, very speedy, powerful aircraft that none of them had ever flown before. These were the Hurricanes and the Spitfires and the Mustang fighters that were crucial to the war and very exciting to fly. All of the women loved flying them. The next category were two-engine bombers that were sent on bombing missions to the continent. And the final category was four-engine bombers, very large bombers like the Flying Fortress, the Lancaster, that many people wondered, could women fly such a large plane? One of the women who did said, the idea is for the plane to lift me, not for me to lift the plane.
You said a lot of these women were hoping to find jobs as pilots in the US after the war. How did that work out for them?
Yeah, there are several threads that run throughout the book, and one is the progress of the war and their contribution to it. But always top of mind for these pilots was their ambition to continue flying somehow after the war, and how difficult they knew that would be because there was a lot of opposition to women flying in the United States. So throughout, they were constantly scheming and planning and trying to fly types of aircraft that would help them to get these jobs. After the war, it was very tough. The US military still did not accept women pilots for quite some time. Commercial aircraft would not have any women pilots also for decades. The first one was 1973. So they had to be very resourceful to find ways to be able to fly after the war. Some of them taught flying, which was fairly dull compared to the extremely exciting work they'd been doing in Great Britain. One of them formed a company with her husband, and they privately delivered aircraft around the world, often aircraft in very dicey condition. They might deliver something from Thailand to Brazil, where there was a buyer, or from France to some other place. They flew all over the world, and it continued to be very dangerous work that they were doing. One of them eventually became the first woman vice president of a United States airline. One of them rose fairly high in the Air Force, although she was never allowed to fly for it. And I'll tell you about Nancy Miller, the last surviving pilot. After the war, the only job she could get was at a flying school in Oregon, where part of her job was cleaning the bathrooms. But she took her time there to learn to fly helicopters. She became only the second woman in the United States to have a commercial helicopter license. She and her husband went to Alaska and founded the first helicopter charter company in Alaska, which eventually had a large fleet of helicopters and was very successful. So they had to find unusual paths to continue doing what they loved, and some of them succeeded.
Well, Becky, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. What do you hope readers most take away from Spitfires?
Well, this story was really exciting and dramatic, yet somehow got lost after the war. So I do hope that people who read it will realize that there are a lot of occupations where people think women or certain other groups shouldn't be doing that work, that they didn't have that capability. This shows that way back then, decades before other women had these opportunities, these women seized this opportunity and they excelled at it. I hope that it gives confidence to people who are thinking, should I try this or shouldn't I? And they can read this story and realize, yes, people like me have succeeded and made a great contribution to the world. I hope that is the lasting legacy of the story.
Becky Aikman is the author of Spitfires, The American Women Who Flew in the Face of Danger During World War II. It's out now through Bloomsbury Publishing. Becky, thanks again.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Our next guest is Christina Hillsburg, a writer who has been researching the history of America's women spies. Technically, she's one of them. Hillsburg is a Swahili and Zulu linguist who spent nearly a decade working for the CIA in Africa, collecting information and providing analytic assessments on African politics for the U.S. When we think of spies, the first image that often comes to mind is James Bond, and then perhaps his Bond girls. But first off, Hillsburg says espionage doesn't often look like it does in the movies. I mean, sometimes it does, but there's a notable lack of Hollywood-scale explosions and high-speed car chases that undoubtedly would get you noticed in the real world. And two, women in espionage are not just arm candy. They've been doing great work for decades, and in some ways, Hillsburg says they're better equipped to be spies. She highlights some of the CIA's most notable women in her new book, Agents of Change, The Women Who Transformed the CIA.
For women in particular, it has long been a fight of proving our worth. Okay, so women were in operational training at the farm as early as the 1960s, but it was a very small percentage. And, you know, like 4% of every class. So if you had a class of 90, there were only a handful of women. And then a woman had to prove her ability to run operations, to be in the field. And she often had to find a man who was an ally and was willing to sponsor her to go through operational training, a chief of station who wanted to have a woman. And I say a woman, because usually if they had one, they checked the box. But it took a long time for women to have equal opportunities at the CIA. And so I trace that evolution from 1960 to present day in the book.
Well, tell me about some of these women who, as you say in the book, you know, transformed the CIA.
Most of them I didn't know during my time there, with the exception of one, and I got to know her on a much deeper level through interviewing her. But it was fantastic to interview women across generations. There is something really special about talking with a woman in her 80s about her experience at the CIA in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, feeling that bond and those parallels, for better or worse, with my experience some decades later. So when I started in 1960, I introduced the reader to three primary women. There's Lucy, who was a Wellesley graduate with, you know, graduated with the world seemingly at her feet, wanted an international career, thought she'd join the Peace Corps, very similar to my own story, and coincidentally fell into a CIA career just as I did. And so I trace her story, going into China ops, doing covert influence campaigns. And then I also talk about a woman named Jeanine Bruckner, who became very important to the women's movement within the CIA and was responsible for a watershed moment when she actually sued the agency after she was wrongfully accused of sexual harassment later in the 90s. So we follow her upward trajectory and then unexpected downfall in the way she turned that around in her life. And really, really fascinating story. And then the third woman that we start with is a woman named Marty Peterson, who was the first woman to operate clandestinely in Moscow in the 70s. And she actually began as what they called a CIA wife. She was a contractor. Her husband was stationed in Laos, and she did things like file and type and wrap the pouch to send information back to headquarters. But Marty was actually highly overqualified for such things. And after her husband unfortunately was shot down in a helicopter and she became a widow, she then entered the CIA in her own right and became a case officer and, went to Moscow. And I go into all of those thrilling details and why she was able to be so successful as a woman there and how that actually was one of the reasons why, the primary reason why she was able to conduct dead drops, because it never dawned on the KGB that we would be using a woman for such things. And so she was able to go virtually unnoticed, conducting these operations.
When you say a dead drop, what is a dead drop?
So a dead drop is when you or your asset are leaving information for the other person. So, for example, the source, he was known by codename Trigon. He was recruited in Latin America and then returned to Moscow. And one of the things he requested was an L pill or a suicide pill of poison, so that if he were to be arrested by the KGB, he wouldn't be subjected to torture. He could choose to take his own life. It sounds like something from the movies because it is, and that isn't something ordinarily the CIA would provide to its asset. But because he was such a high value asset for us, we considered it and ultimately it was approved. And so Marty actually took that L pill disguised in a log and took it to an agreed upon location. You drop it's usually, disguised as something someone wouldn't want to pick up as garbage, trash, a log, and then the asset will then come later and pick up the package when you're not there. And that's also a way that an asset can deliver intelligence that they've collected for their CIA handler.
And you say in your book that women, because of their experiences and because, like you said, like so many people weren't expecting a woman to be doing these things, that this makes them actually like very well equipped to be spies. Tell me a little bit more about that.
That's so true. I think women are able to leverage the fact that we are underestimated and we can be unnoticed. The CIA operates in environments all over the world with different cultural views. And so if it is a particular culture that doesn't value women, women can be in the background and, stealing secrets right under the noses of foreign governments, which is exactly what we want to do, right? We don't want to cause a big car chase scene like James Bond. We want to be doing things without them realizing it. And so women are able to use that to their advantage. Additionally, there were things that came up multiple times during my interviews. And I interviewed dozens of women. In addition to the three I mentioned, we go into the next generation of women and you meet some more. But the theme that kept coming up is that women felt that we bring qualities and traits to the table that make us advantageous spies. Now, you could argue that some of them sound like generalizations, but when they come up so many times anecdotally, it's hard to ignore. So, for instance, women often said, we're better listeners for our assets, we're nurturing, we are more detail-oriented, we notice things that our male colleagues wouldn't notice, like a surveillance socks or shoes. Oftentimes, assets can feel more comfortable with a woman handler because they don't feel the pressure to impress their male handler and, outdo them. And so they can feel more comfortable sharing. At the same time, women work things to their advantage, like, oh, silly me, I'm just a silly woman who doesn't know anything. And then they end up getting all this information, right? So we play on those stereotypes. At the same time, it also brings its challenges, right? Women have to be very clear about boundaries, that this is a professional relationship. And so women told me all the different ways that they would ensure that was clear. And it was everything from I dressed as unattractive as possible to I made sure the bed was never in line of sight if we were in a hotel meeting, which is very common. So that's something women have to think about as well.
As you're interviewing these women across different generations, are there ways in which you've seen the environment for women in the CIA change, or has it really not changed a whole lot since then?
There were some days after my interviews where I felt the progress very strongly. There were other days when I felt like, wow, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So I would say the answer to that is it's very nuanced, but there has been progress. And this book really is meant to be a celebration of that progress. And I was very transparent with the CIA because as a former officer, I have to, send my manuscript through their review. And I worked closely with them so that I could interview some current women at the agency. And I was very transparent and told them, listen, this book is meant to be celebratory. I'm going to talk about the progress the agency has made, but I'm not going to shy away from the parts of the history that are unfavorable. So we are at a point now where women make up around 50% of the organization, which is fantastic. Now, if you look at breakdown in each directorate, that varies. And a lot of those numbers are coming from more of the support directorate and those logistics roles. If you look at the Directorate of Operations, which is what I focus on in the book, it's much less, particularly when you're looking at women in senior positions. We had our first female CIA director in 2018, Dina Haspel. And then we also had our first woman director of operations, which is arguably an even bigger deal when it comes to clandestine operations, because that person, Elizabeth Kimber, is in charge of all clandestine operations worldwide. So, very huge milestone. But we do still see a drop off of women at those higher levels. And so, that is an ongoing process of improvement.
I'm glad you brought up having to clear things with the CIA because I was wondering, I imagine there are some stories that are classified and that you literally can't share, and maybe some that you think you need permission for.
Surprisingly, the CIA was fantastic to work with on this. And I had worked with them on my previous book as well, and that was a great experience. But you, of course, hear these horror stories. And so you never know. You're sending in your manuscript and you're just hoping that it doesn't delay your publishing. But they actually were really great to work with on this. And I had a really good sense for what I could share and what I couldn't, having had worked there myself. Things like locations, those specifics, anything particularly identifying in operations, I made sure to leave some of those out or change them beforehand. And then, of course, there are those random things that they'll have you take out that are readily available in the press that kind of are head scratchers. But by and large, the redactions were minimal, which is great, particularly with the more recent chapters, like towards the end of the book on the recent years. I was concerned about how they would handle that because I do highlight the current dilemma the agency has been facing with regards to their mishandling of sexual harassment and sexual assault. So I did have concerns that they would try to censor that information and they didn't touch it, which is great because I think it's very important. A really crucial theme to this book is this idea of holding our institutions accountable. And we saw, in 2020, the pandemic started, and we saw this great resignation of women leaving the workforce and showing how important they were to society, to our economy. All of a sudden, schools are closed down, and it's mostly women who are now staying home and caring for their kids, right? And we were seeing some of this at the CIA as well. And with the ushering of this new decade, we were also seeing a reckoning of sorts. And that is this younger generation that isn't afraid to speak up and feels energized, and they're not going to turn a blind eye to things that for so long women at the CIA felt would be career suicide if they spoke up. And it was. I mean, if you look at Jeanine Bruckner, who I profile in the book, case in point. So that actually really came to a head, and we have seen some concrete progress on that. Congress passed the Intelligence Authorization Act, which calls for a mechanism, a reporting mechanism for CIA to actually report sexual harassment and assault to Congress. There's congressional oversight, and I think that that's very important because when you look at an environment that is male dominated, but then you also add the layer of secrecy, and that makes it very complex because for years, women were discouraged from going to law enforcement because they had to deal with this idea of being undercover. And if you go to law enforcement, you're going to jeopardize your cover and your career here. You will jeopardize your colleagues cover who you're accusing, and it's a federal crime to release an agency officer's name, who's undercover, and so a lot of intimidation. So having those women come up and speak up rather and go to Congress and establish this is very important. So that is a big step towards progress as well.
Well, Christina, thanks so much for joining us and speaking with us today. I guess I'm wondering, do you share any of your own experiences in the book? What would you say the job is like? Because I feel like for most of us, it sounds very Hollywood.
Yes, there are so many things that we see on TV that give us the wrong idea about espionage. The number one being that people often think that women are exchanging sex for foreign intelligence, which is 100% not the case. And so one of the reasons why I, wanted to structure the book in the way that I did was to use those cultural touchstones that we know so well. And so I actually go through the decades, and each one I start with our conceptions of the female spy, what was going on with the Bond girl at that time, before I get into what was going on at the CIA, because I really wanted to write a book that appealed to readers beyond history buffs and spy aficionados, people who wanted to read about interesting women doing extraordinary things that is nothing like what they've seen in the movies, is so much more impressive and extraordinary. But at the end of the day, these are women who we can relate to because so much of their stories resonate with all of us, whether we have experience in espionage or not. And you get a little taste of my experience as I am your narrator throughout the book, commenting on things here and there. But by and large, my goal was to amplify the voices of these incredible women who blazed the trail for me and so many others. And what I hope this book shows more than anything is that women are vital to national security. And I hope that young women will read this book and go into the agency eyes wide open, understanding the women who have gone before them and the shoulders on which they'll stand.
Christina Hilsberg is a former CIA intelligence officer and the author of Agents of Change: The Women Who Transformed the CIA. It's out now through Citadel Press, and you can learn more about Christina's work now as a writer at christinahilsberg.com. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The nightmare down the hallway. I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.